Chapter 17. For a few days I peddled kitchen utensils, graters, knives, vegetable peelers, small objects for which no suspicious-looking suitcase is needed. Twice I came home earlier than usual and found Helen gone. I waited, growing more and more worried, but the concierge assured me that no one had come for her, that she had gone out a few hours before, that she often went out. It was late when she came in. Her face was hostile. She did not look at me. I didn't know what to do, but not to ask would have been stranger than asking. "Helen, where have you been?" I asked finally.
"Out for a walk."
"In this weather?"
"Yes, in this weather. Don't try to keep tabs on me."
"I'm not trying to keep tabs on you," I said. "I was only worried that the police had picked you up." She laughed harshly.
"The police will never get me."
I wish I could believe that. She glared at me.
"If you keep on asking questions, I'll go out again. I can't stand being watched all the time. Can't you see that? The houses outside don't watch me. I'm of no interest to them. And I'm of no interest to the people on the street. They don't ask me questions, and they don't watch me."
I saw what she meant. Outside, no one knew of her sickness. Outside, she was not a patient, but a woman, and she wanted to go on being a woman. She wanted to live. To be a patient meant a slow death. At night, she cried in her sleep. In the morning, everything was forgotten. It was the darkness she could not bear. It settled like a poisoned spider web on her terrified heart. I saw that she needed more and more sedatives. I spoke to Lewison, formerly a doctor, now a peddler of horoscopes. He told me it was too late for anything else. Just what Dubois had told me. She often came home late after that. She was afraid I would question her. I didn't. Once a bunch of roses was delivered when I was alone. I went out, and when I came back, the roses were gone. She began to drink. Friends found it necessary to tell me that they had seen her in bars, not alone. I clung to my last hope, the American consulate. By now I had permission to wait in the lobby, but the days passed and nothing happened. Then I was caught. I was 20 paces from the consulate when suddenly the police set up a cordon. I tried to get through, and that made them suspicious. Once inside, you were safe. I saw Lachman disappear in the doorway and broke loose in an attempt to follow him, but a gendarme thrust out his leg and tripped me. "Keep a good hold on that one," said a smiling young man in civilian clothes. "He's in too much of a hurry." Our papers were checked. 6 of us were held. The police withdrew, leaving us in the hands of a group of civilians. We were loaded into a closed truck and taken to a house in the suburbs. It was isolated, with a big garden around it. "It sounds like a Class B film," said Schwartz. "But have the last years been anything but a stupid, bloodthirsty movie?" "Was it the Gestapo?" I asked. Schwartz nodded. "Today it seems a miracle that they hadn't laid hands on me before. I knew that Georg wouldn't stop looking for us." The smiling young man mentioned Georg the moment he saw my papers. Unfortunately, I had Helen's passport on me, too. I had thought I might need it at the consulate. "At last we've got our little fish," said the young man. "The female won't be long in coming." He smiled and punched me in the face. He seemed to have rings on all his fingers. "Do you agree with me, Schwartz?" I wiped the blood off my lips. There were 2 other men in the room, also in plain clothes. "Or might it be wiser," the young man said, "to tell us the address?" "I haven't got it," I answered. "I've been looking for my wife myself. We quarreled a week ago and she ran away."
"Quarreled? How nasty!"
Again the young man hit me in the face.
"There! That's for quarreling with your wife."
"Should we swing him, Chief?"
asked one of the gorillas. The young man with the girlish face smiled. Tell him what swinging is, Müller. Müller explained that a telephone wire would be tied around my genitals, and then they'd swing me. Know what it's like? Asked the young man. After all, you've been in a camp. I didn't know. My invention, he said, but we can start with something simpler. We bind off your jewels so tight that not a drop of blood can get through. In an hour or so, you'll be making a fine hullabaloo. To quiet you down, we stuff your little mouth with sawdust. His eyes were light blue and strangely glassy. We're full of interesting little ideas, he went on. Have you ever stopped to think what can be done with a little fire? The gorillas laughed. With a fine red-hot wire, said the smiling young man. Remarkable results are obtained by introducing it slowly into the ears or up through the nostrils, Mr. Schwartz. We're very fortunate in having you here to help us with our experiments. He stepped hard on my feet. I could smell his perfume. I did not move. I knew it was useless to resist and even more to make a display of courage. My tormentors would have been only too delighted to break down my resistance. At the next blow, administered with a cane, I collapsed with a moan. They all guffawed. Revive him, Müller, said the young man tenderly. Müller drew at his cigarette and pressed it to my eyelid. It was as if fire had been poured into my eye. The three roared with laughter. Get up, son, said the smile. I staggered to my feet. I was hardly up when he struck me again. This is only warming up exercises, he explained. We have time. A whole lifetime. Yours. The next time you take it into your head to malinger, we have a marvelous surprise in store for you. You'll hit the ceiling. I wasn't malingering, I said. I've got a bad heart. It's perfectly possible that I won't get up next time, whatever you do. The smile turned to the gorillas. Our boy says his heart is bad. Should we believe him? He hit me again, but I could see I had made an impression. He couldn't hand me over to Georg, dead. Have you remembered that address? He asked. It would be easier to tell us now while you still have some teeth. I don't know it. I wish I did. Our boy's a hero. How touching! Too bad that nobody but us will ever know. He kicked me until he was tired. I lay on the floor, trying to protect my face and genitals. Seems like enough for now, he said finally. Lock him up in the cellar. After dinner, we'll really get started. Night sessions are so stimulating. I was familiar with this sort of thing. It was as much a part of German culture as Goethe and Schiller, and I had been through it in the camp. But I had my poison on me. They had searched me, but not very carefully. They hadn't found it. I also had a razor blade inserted in a strip of cork sewn loosely into the cuff of my trousers. They hadn't found that either. I lay in the darkness. Of course, I was in despair. But strange to say, what really got me down wasn't so much the dark prospects as the thought of my stupidity in getting caught. Lachmann had seen them arrest me. He didn't know it was the Gestapo because the French police seemed to be involved. But if I were not back in 24 hours at the most, Helen would try to reach me through the police and probably find out who had arrested me. But would the smile wait for that to happen? I assumed that Georg would be notified immediately. If Georg was in Marseille, he would interview me that night. He was in Marseille, all right. Helen's eyes had not deceived her. He came and gave me his personal attention. I won't bore you with the details. When I passed out, they poured water on me and dragged me back to the cellar. It was only the poison I had that enabled me to hold out. Luckily, Georg had no patience with the refined tortures that the smile had promised me. But in his own way, he was no slouch. He came back later that night. He brought in a stool, and there he sat in all his barrel-chested self-righteousness, a symbol of the absolute power we thought we had left behind us in the 19th century, and which nevertheless, or perhaps for that very reason, became the hallmark of the 20th. That day I saw two embodiments of evil, the smile and Georg, absolute evil and unadulterated brutality. If distinctions are in order, the smile was the worse of the two. He tortured for the pleasure of it, Georg to impose his will. Meanwhile, I had thought up a plan. I had to get out of that house. When Georg came back, I acted as if I were completely broken. I'd tell him everything, I said, if he would spare me. He had the well-fed, contemptuous grin of a man who has never been in such a situation, and consequently believes that if he were, he would behave like a hero in a schoolbook. The fact is that his type goes to pieces completely. "I know," I said. "I once heard a Gestapo officer screaming because he had squashed his thumb in an iron chain he was beating somebody to death with. The man who was being beaten didn't let out a peep." "Georg kicked me," said Schwartz. "Oh-ho," he said. "So now we're trying to bargain." "I'm not trying to bargain," I replied. "But if you take Helen to Germany, she'll run away or kill herself." "Nonsense," Georg snarled. "Life doesn't mean very much to Helen," I said. "She knows she has cancer, and that it's incurable." He stared at me. "That's a lie, you swine. She hasn't got cancer. It's one of those women's ailments." "She has cancer. It was discovered the first time she was operated on in Zurich. Even then, it was too late. The doctor told her so." "What doctor?" "The surgeon who operated on her. She wanted to know." "The inhuman swine!" Georg roared. "But I'll get him too. Switzerland will be German in another year." "I wanted Helen to go back," I said. "She refused. But I think she'd go if I were to break with her." "That's ridiculous. I could be so beastly that she'd hate me for the rest of her life," I said. I saw that Georg's mind was working. I had propped up my head in my hands and was watching him. I had a pain between the eyes from trying to force my will upon him. "How?" he answered finally. "She thinks I'd find her repulsive if I knew of her sickness. That's her greatest fear. If I said that, she'd be through with me for good." Georg pondered. I could follow his thoughts. He saw that my suggestion offered him his best chance. Even if he tortured Helen's address out of me, she would go on hating him. But if I behaved like a scoundrel, she would hate me, and he could step forward as her savior and say, "I told you so." "Where does she live?" he asked. I gave a false address. "But there are half a dozen ways out," I said, "through cellars and other streets. If the police try to arrest her, she can easily escape. She won't run away if I go alone." "Or I," said Georg. "She'd think you had killed me. She has poison."
"Nonsense!"
I waited.
"And what do you ask in return?" Georg asked.
"That you let me go." He smiled for a moment, showing his teeth like a beast of prey. I knew that he'd never let me go.
"All right," he said. "Come along with me. That way you won't try any tricks. You'll tell her in my presence."
I nodded.
"Let's go," he said.
He stood up.
"Clean yourself up at the faucet over there." "I'm taking him with me," he said to one of the gorillas, who was lounging in a room decorated with antlers. The gorilla saluted and escorted us to Georg's car. "Get in here beside me," said Georg. "Do you know the way?"
Not from here. From the Canbier.
We drove off into the cold, windy night. I had hoped to drop out of the car when it slowed or stopped, but Georg had locked my door. It wouldn't have done any good to scream. No one would think of responding to cries from a German car. And before my scream was half out, Georg would have knocked me unconscious.
You'd better be telling me the truth, Georg snarled, or I'll have you skinned and rolled in pepper.
I huddled in my seat. When Georg jammed on the brakes to avoid an unlighted cart, I let myself fall forward.
Coward! Georg snapped at me. This is no time to play sick.
I feel faint, I said, slowly picking myself up.
Weakling!
I had ripped open the threads in my cuff. The second time he had to brake, I located the razor blade. The third time, I bumped my head against the windshield. When I settled back in the seat, I had the blade in my hand. Schwartz looked up. His forehead was bathed in sweat. He would never have let me go, he said.
Do you believe me?
Of course I believe you. As we were rounding a curve, I shouted as loud as I could,
Watch out on the left!
The unexpected cry took Georg unawares. His head turned automatically to the left. He braked and gripped the wheel. I lashed out at him. It wasn't a big blade, but it caught him in the side of the neck. I pulled it forward hard across his windpipe. He let go the wheel and clutched his throat. Then he sagged against the door. His arm hit the handle. The car hurtled into a clump of bushes. The door flew open and Georg fell out. He was wheezing and bleeding heavily. I climbed out and listened. All I could hear was the roaring of the motor. I turned it off. The wind seemed to howl in the silence, but it was the blood in my ears. I watched Georg and looked for the blade with the strip of cork. It glinted on the running board. I picked it up and waited. I thought Georg might jump up at any moment. Then a quiver ran through his legs, and he was still. I threw the blade away, but picked it up again and stuck it in the ground. I turned off the lights and listened. Not a sound. I hadn't thought about what to do next. Now I had to act quickly. Every minute's head start counted. I removed Georg's clothes and tied them up in a bundle. Then I dragged the body into the bushes. He wouldn't be found for some time, and then it would take a while to identify him. If I were in luck, they would list him as unknown. I checked the car. It was undamaged. I drove it back on the road. I vomited. In the car, I found a flashlight. There was blood on the seat and on the door. Both were leather and easy to clean. There was water in the ditch, and I used Georg's shirt as a rag. I also wiped the running board. I inspected the whole car with the flashlight and kept wiping until it was clean. Then I washed myself and got in. It nauseated me to be sitting in Georg's place. I had the feeling that he would leap at me out of the darkness. I drove off. I left the car in a side street a little way from the house. It had begun to rain. I crossed the street, breathing deeply. Gradually, I began to feel the aches in my body. I stopped outside a fish store. There was a mirror at the side of the window. I couldn't see much in the dark silver, but as far as I could make out, my face was swollen. I took a deep breath of the damp air. I could hardly believe that I had been there that same afternoon. I managed to slip by the concierge unseen. She was already asleep and just mumbled something. It was not unusual for me to come in late. Quickly, I mounted the stairs. Helen was not there. I stared at the bed and the clothes cupboard. Awakened by the light, the canary began to sing. The cat came to the window with its phosphorescent eyes and peered in like a damned soul. I waited for a time. Then I crept over to Lockman's door and knocked softly. He awoke at once. Fugitives are light sleepers.
"Are you?" he began.
Then he took a look at me and fell silent. "Have you seen my wife?" I asked. He shook his head. "She's been away. She wasn't back an hour ago." "Thank God." He looked at me as if I had gone mad. "Thank God," I repeated. "Then she probably hasn't been arrested. She's just gone out."
"Just gone out," Lockman repeated. "What's happened to you?" he asked then.
"They questioned me. I got away."
"The police?"
"The Gestapo. It's all over. Go back to sleep."
"Does the Gestapo know where you are?"
"If they did, I wouldn't be here. I'll be gone before morning."
"Wait a second."
Lockman rummaged about and came back with some rosaries and holy pictures.
"Here, take these with you. Sometimes they do wonders. They got Hirsch across the border. The people in the Pyrenees are very religious. These things have been blessed by the Pope himself."
"Really?" His smile was beautiful.
"If they save us," he said, "they've been blessed by God himself."
"Goodbye, Schwartz." I went back to the room and packed our things. I felt utterly empty, but tense, like a drum with nothing inside. In Helen's drawer, I discovered a packet of letters addressed to her in care of General Delivery, Marseille. I thought nothing and put them in her bag. I also put in her evening dress from Paris. Then I sat down at the wash basin and turned on the water. My burnt nails ached, and it hurt me to breathe. I looked at the wet roofs and thought nothing. At last I heard Helen's steps. She stood in the doorway like a beautiful, ravaged ghost.
"What are you doing?"
She knew nothing.
"What's wrong?"
"We've got to get out of Marseille," I said, "right away."
"Georg?"
I nodded. I had decided to tell her as little as possible.
"What have they done to you?"
she asked in a fright and came closer. "They arrested me. I escaped. They'll be looking for me."
"Where can we go?"
"Spain."
"How?"
"As far as possible in a car. Can you make it quick?"
"Yes."
She winced. "Are you in pain?" I asked. She nodded. "Who is that in the doorway?" I thought. "Who is it?" She was a stranger to me. "Are there any ampoules left?" I asked.
"Not very many."
"We'll get some more."
"Leave me for a moment," she said.
I stood in the hallway. Doors opened a crack. Faces appeared with the eyes of lemurs, one-eyed faces with crooked mouths. Lockman, in long gray underdrawers, darted up the stairs like a grasshopper and pressed a half-full bottle of cognac into my hand.
"It will come in handy," he whispered. "VSOP.
I took a good swig on the spot. "Could you sell me another bottle?" I asked. "Here, I have plenty of money." My first impulse had been to throw Georg's briefcase away, but I had quickly changed my mind. In it, I had found a considerable sum of money, and, better still, his passport, along with Helen's and my own. I had weighted down Georg's clothes with a stone and tossed them in the harbor. Then, after carefully examining Georg's passport under the flashlight, I went to Gregorius's room and woke him up. Would he fix up Georg's passport for me with my photo? At first he was horrified and flatly refused. His business was rectifying the passports of refugees, and in the performance of it he felt more righteous than God, whom he held responsible for the whole mess, but he had never before laid eyes on the passport of a high Gestapo official. I told him that he wouldn't have to sign his work like a painting, that the responsibility was all mine, and that no one would know he had anything to do with it. "What if they torture you?" I showed him my hand and face. "I'll be gone in an hour," I said. "As a refugee, I wouldn't get 10 miles with my face in this state, and I've got to get out of France. This is my only chance. Here's my passport. Photograph the picture and put the copy on the Gestapo passport. What's the charge? I have money." Gregorius finally consented. Lachmann brought the second bottle of cognac. I paid him and went back to my room. Helen was standing by the bedside table. The drawer where the letters had been was open. She banged it shut and came over to me. "Did Georg do that?" she asked. "It was a committee," I said. "Damn his soul!" She went to the window. The cat fled. She opened the shutters. "Damn his soul!" she repeated with the deep, passionate conviction of a medicine man cursing the enemies of his tribe. "Damn his soul in this world and the next!" I took hold of her clenched fists and drew her away from the window. "We've got to be going." We went down the stairs. Eyes followed us from every door. A gray arm motioned. "Schwartz! Don't take a knapsack. The police are on the lookout for knapsacks. I have an artificial leather suitcase, cheap and very chic." "Thank you," I said. "I don't need a suitcase. I need luck." "We'll keep our fingers crossed." Helen had gone ahead. I could hear a dripping streetwalker who had taken refuge in the doorway advising her to stay home. You couldn't do any business in this rain. Good, I thought. As far as I was concerned, the streets couldn't be too deserted. "Where did that come from?" asked Helen when she saw the car. "Stolen," I said. "It ought to take us part of the way. Get in." It was still dark. The rain streamed down the windshield. If there was still any blood on the running board, it would be washed away now. I stopped a little way from the house where Gregorius lived. "Stand under there," I said to Helen, pointing to the glass overhang protecting the entrance of a store dealing in fishing equipment.
"Can't I stay in the car?"
"No. If someone turns up, act as if you were waiting for customers. I'll be right back." Gregorius had finished. His fear had given way to artist's pride. "The only difficulty was the uniform," he explained. "Your picture has civilian clothes, so I cut off his head." He had detached Georg's picture, cut out the head and neck, laid the uniform over my photo, and photographed the montage. "Obersturmbannführer Schwartz," he said proudly. He had already dried and attached the copy. "The stamp came out pretty well. If they look at it carefully, I have to admit you're done for. You would be even if it were authentic. Here's your old passport, unharmed." He gave me both passports and what was left of Georg's photo. I tore up the photograph into small pieces on my way down the stairs and threw the fragments into the water that was racing down the gutter. Helen was waiting. I had checked the gas. The tank was full. With luck, that would take us across the border. In the glove compartment, I found a cornet, the document required for taking a car across borders. It had been used twice. I decided not to cross where the car had already been seen. I also found a Michelin map, a pair of gloves, and a motorist's atlas of Europe. We drove through the rain. We still had a few hours before daylight, and we headed for Perpignan. I decided to stay on the main road until it was light. "Would you like me to drive?" Helen asked after a time. "Your hands..." "Can you? You haven't slept."
"Neither have you."
I looked at her. She seemed fresh and calm, though I don't see how she managed it. "Like some cognac?"
"No, I'll drive until we can get some coffee."
Lachmann gave me another bottle of cognac. I took it out of my coat pocket. Helen shook her head. She had her injection.
Later, she said to me very gently, try to sleep. We'll take turns driving.
Helen was a better driver than I. After a while, she began to sing monotonous, childish songs. I had been all keyed up. Now the humming of the car and her soft sing-song began to lull me. I knew that I ought to sleep, but I kept waking up. The gray countryside flew by, and we used the bright lights, ignoring the blackout regulations.
Did you kill him?
Helen asked suddenly. Yes.
Did you have to?
Yes. We drove on. I stared at the road. All sorts of things drifted through my mind. And then I passed out like a stone. When I awoke, the rain had stopped. It was morning. The car was humming. Helen was at the wheel. And I had the feeling that I had dreamt it all. What I told you isn't true, I said.
I know, she said.
It was somebody else, I said.
I know.
She did not look at me.